Good evening, friends, and welcome to another edition of the Antique Phonograph Music Program. Here I am, your host, Mac, doing another program, as I like to do occasionally, I call remote recordings, where I get to visit the home of a collector, get to see their records, their machines, and get a little insight into their perspective on the hobby. And tonight with me is Mr. Lyndon Lowell Blaylock. He's a gentleman I met through a site I created on Facebook called Antique Phonograph Enthusiasts. So we became friendly, and here I am in his home today. So thank you for having me in your home today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to have you.
Absolutely. We've been talking a little bit about your interest in machines and records. And when I asked you about doing a show, you came to me with the perspective of doing it from opera recordings, because that's one of your big interests.
That is correct. Most of my records are opera recordings, but well, it's all going to be pretty much semi-classical music. I thought we'd do a little Gershwin tonight.
Right.
This first recording is from 1928. It is the first recording of Gershwin's Concerto in F.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally done for a big symphony orchestra, but this version was reorchestrated by Paul Whiteman's great orchestrator, Ferdy Groffé, and for his orchestra. The pianist is Roy Bargy, a very, very fine pianist, quite different from what you generally hear today. Generally, we hear this in a very symphonic, smooth style, and this is the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and so it sounds quite different.
Roy Bargy, people may know from my show as a fantastic ragtime performer, but he also did standards. He seemed to be a pretty versatile piano player.
Absolutely, absolutely. He, I'm sure, was able to play, classical piano, but all of his recordings are of smaller works. This is the largest thing that I'm aware of that he ever recorded.
Well, as a musician, I guess you take the work that's offered to you, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So,
he had a great long career.
We should pause for 1 minute before going to the next thing. Just tell us what we started the program off with.
That was, of course, George Gershwin again, played by Paul Whiteman's orchestra. That record was 1926, one of their very first electric recordings made in front of a microphone instead of a recording horn.
Mm-hmm.
The music was brand new at that time. That's from Lady Be Good. And that was the first recording from that show.
All right. Now, this for the concerto in F,
yes,
we're going to hear six consecutive sides, right?
Six consecutive sides.
Which is, we're dealing with a 78, which is, we're doing 12 inches, so about 4 minutes a side.
Exactly.
And to get a whole piece in, you'd have to break it up.
Exactly. You know, this was a very impressive, very large prestige endeavor at that time. So, obviously Gershwin was held in very high esteem, and they had high hopes for this record. And I think it sold reasonably well, but there aren't many copies of it left, so it cannot have been a huge seller for them.
I remember reading this story. I think it was Pathé did a series of a whole opera on cylinder, mm-hmm, in the 1890s. It was like 40 cylinders or
yes,
something. What
yes,
was that one? Do you know
yes,
anything about that?
Absolutely. From the very beginning, they started trying to record whole operas. Or almost whole operas, always in Europe at this time. And, since from the turn of the century, they started doing this. In this country, they started releasing operas on flat discs, and they would generally be about 40 sides, so 20 records.
Wow.
And that's an evening's worth of entertainment, with the getting up, cranking the machine, changing the needles.
Absolutely.
Going back and forth. It's as long as, as long as you can, devote.
Today we have TV with commercials, so, I had the built-in breaks, so you can go get a drink, use the bathroom.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's actually a very nice way to listen to records. And very often, some of us get used to hearing our classical music in 4 minute segments. And then when you go to the concert hall, it's a little disconcerting to hear things all played in one piece.
A true mark of a collector of 78s to say that.
I'm afraid that's true.
So let's go. Let's start it.
All right, here we are. Thank you.
Okay, so we're pausing now at the end of that first movement.
Yes.
So, yeah, like you said before, that's new music coming out.
Absolutely. That's you can hear how excited the musicians are to be playing this. This is by far the most exciting version of this music on record, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's got a freshness that modern symphony orchestras generally cannot bring to it. It sounds very rough. It sounds as if it's, you know, sort of a garage band kind of sound almost here and there. The percussion is jazz band percussion instruments, but it sounds wonderful.
So they would have had the sheet music for this. They would have made their own arrangement for it. Because how would it have originally been put out by Gershwin? Was it performed first and then they did the recording? Was the sequence?
Well, after Rhapsody in Blue was a great success, Walter Damrosch, who was the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, asked Gershwin to write an even more elaborate, formal, big classical type composition. But he wanted Gershwin to orchestrate it himself. In the classical world, a composer always orchestrates his own work, or it's not taken seriously. Gershwin, although he was fairly unfamiliar with orchestral, you know, arranging techniques at this time, learned fast and was able to do this. So the New York Philharmonic premiered this work with its all 90 instruments.
And what year was that?
That was 1926.
Okay.
This was shortly after, you know, 1 year after the Rhapsody had premiered. So Whiteman wanted to do a recording of it. He had done the original recordings, of course, of Rhapsody in Blue and wanted to do it. But he obviously did not have a 90-piece orchestra in the studio. And so he had it arranged for his normal augmented jazz band. This is larger than he usually used for his, you know, general dance arrangements, but still it's much smaller than a big symphony. And so it has that sort of rough and ready sound, but we don't know exactly what Gershwin thought about this. I'm sure he was delighted to get the royalties and happy that it was recorded. It was not recorded again for some years, you know, after he was
dead. 10 years?
At least. It wasn't recorded until after Gershwin was dead.
Mm-hmm.
So he never got a chance to record it with himself playing the piano part. The main reason that he's not recording it, that he's not on this piano part, is that Whiteman had jumped ship to the Columbia Company for about a year. And so this is recorded on the Columbia label. And Gershwin recorded only for Victor. So,
has this Columbia recording been reissued at this point onto CD or something?
It's possible that it has. I imagine that it's out there someplace on a small label, you know, that somebody has got it available, but I'm not sure.
Well,
exactly where it is.
As you know, we love hearing the original recordings on the original machines. By the way, what kind of machine are we hearing today this on?
This is a Victrola Credenza model, which was one of their first so-called orthophonic models that they brought out shortly after the advent of electrical recording. So it's a little bit bigger. It's got sort of a big horn.
The folded horn.
The big folded horn,
yeah,
yes.
So, and this is a, should point out, it's a machine that the motor is driven electrically.
Yes.
But it's the orthophonic playback.
Exactly. This machine was available with a crank and with an electric motor. Only, you know, a very small number of them were actually sold with electric motors because it was more expensive. But it's a trade-off. It's sort of fun to crank the machines, but then if you happen to be doing a 40-side opera during the evening, it's
right.
Actually kind of nice to have the electric motor as well. So,
well, let's continue now. We got three more sides to complete this piece, so let's do that.
All right, here we go.
Well, really wonderful recording, one I'd never heard before. And one thing I was thinking was that these early electrical recordings, it's still one microphone.
Absolutely.
And what's amazing about this is, for example, the clarinet has moments of solo, but then moments it's blending perfectly with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And then really shortly after, you know, just a few bars of piano solo, a few bars of clarinet solo. I heard some cello. Traditionally, with acoustic recordings, those instruments would have to get closer to the recording cone. In this case, it might have been the microphone, but I'm not sure how they achieved that, because such a large orchestra, I don't know, maybe they played louder in certain segments and stood up. I'm not sure how they achieved such clarity, but blending at the same time.
I think they must have come forward at the same time. There are photographs of orchestras being recorded at this time, and it's always a single microphone on a stand in front of the orchestra, you know, with a little bit of distance.
Right.
So I think that the instrumentalist actually did stand up, move forward if they needed to.
And maybe just play louder. Okay,
yes.
At this moment, you got to blow a little harder, clarinet, or
absolutely
blow a little harder for the cello. Could have been something like that. It's a lot of little considerations for that recording, but really beautifully executed.
It is incredible. This recording should be better remembered. But unfortunately, at the time that it came out, it wasn't really so interesting to, you know, popular music, you know, aficionados, and it wasn't that interesting to classical music aficionados, who looked down on it slightly.
Right.
You know, so it's been really misunderstood, you know, through most of its life, and so not that many people have really heard it and studied it. But it's got the best playing by the Whiteman Orchestra, probably of any record.
Well, I feel I can apply what you said to a lot of early recordings, that they've been so misunderstood for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it's only within the last 20 years or so that mm-hmm. they are being more appreciated. I feel classical and jazz enthusiasts always look down on the acoustic era because of the fidelity,
yes.
not the performances. And but now people are looking at the pop music and the opera and so many things, and it's being more appreciated, and it's great to hear it.
Yeah, there's an interesting, you know, it has its own kind of fidelity, but in many ways, I'm sure you agree, it has a more lifelike sound than what we're used to in more recent recordings.
Right. Well, let's move on to our next thing. That was the longest stretch of a serial recording you've ever played on the show, but I was glad to do it.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy that you let me do that.
Of course.
I've got another one that's also slightly longer than usual, but it's a very interesting recording. This is a really forgotten piece of music. It's called A Victory Ball, and it's by Ernest Schelling, who was the assistant conductor for the New York Philharmonic. This was once a very popular piece of music. The Philharmonic played it quite often, and they chose it as their very first electric recording in front of the microphone. It was expected to be a big seller. It was not, apparently. And the piece of music is never heard now. It's completely disappeared, and I'm sure you can't find this this music or this recording anywhere. So this may be the first time that this has been heard on the radio in many decades.
Well, I hope so. Was it written for any specific occasion?
Well, actually, it sort of celebrates the end of World War I, but it's a little grisly. It's actually it's based on a poem by Robert Doyle, and it concerns the irony of frivolous dancing and balls soon after the conflagration of World War I. So thematically, it's very similar to Ravel's La Valse, but whereas that piece of music is still very, very popular, this one has gone completely by the wayside. But it's a fascinating piece of music nonetheless, and a very interesting piece of New York history, and recording history as well.
Fantastic. Well, let's hear it. Thank you. Well, very interesting and dynamic recording.
Yes, I really love that recording. I wouldn't say that it's good music. I couldn't say that. But I think it's fascinating. It's a strange cross between, you know, Strauss and Ravel and a little, you know, all sorts of different things and a lot of Hollywood.
It
sounds very much like a Hollywood film score, but of course this is composed decades before film scoring, you know, came to be recorded. So it's a very strange piece of music, and but that's one of the beauties of old records is mm-hmm. discovering, you know, this is a window into the past.
Right. I heard a lot of I heard the Fancy Ladies quadrilling, uh-huh. juxtaposing to the grind of war. Mm-hmm. Lots of ominous sounds, a little bit of celebration. It's reflecting a lot of the period feelings of
Absolutely.
The end of World War I.
Yeah, this obviously meant a great deal to audiences of that time. And you just sort of have to enter into that spirit, you know, when you listen to this music. And I think if you do that, then it's really fascinating.
Well, that's what people who listen to this show hopefully are doing. I say it's a... I'm not always playing my favorite music. It's a historical perspective on the hobby, which I like to present to people
exactly.
and let them hear it. And yours is a very valuable one, Lyndon, because I really don't get this perspective often. So thank you so much for bringing it to everyone.
It's really a pleasure. I love to share this.
Yes. Well, we'll have to do it again. An hour goes quick. Especially when you're playing six sides in one piece.
I would love to do that.
Well, what is going to be taking us out as our last record?
Well, we're gonna you know, something here, something frivolous from the late 20s, a little more Paul Whiteman. And this is Parade of the Wooden Soldiers, of all things.
A lovely one. All right, I'll be back, folks, next week with another program. Until then, it's your host, Mac, of the Antique Phonograph Music Program, saying nighty-night, everybody.
And this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org.
Now I see the jugs, washboards, and hubcaps are tuned up, so Jim Queskin, what have you got in mind?
First tune is an old Paul Whiteman tune that we originally heard where we were listening to Bick solos, and we weren't paying too much attention to the rest of it, but when we formed this jug band, we realized that what a beautiful tune it was, and so we're going to do Borneo, Borneo Bay.
Do that, Dolores. You should never swat a fly. You know, he may have another fly. I may sit with her and sigh, sigh the way I do with you. With you, Dolores. Now, you know, you should never harm a flea. Cause he may have a favorite sheep. That he bouncy, wouncy, wounces on his knee. His little flea knee the way I do with you. We're coming to the hymenoptera now. You know you should never harm a bee. If he is going anywhere. That's right. Cause you could be busting up. Should be concluded some fantastic insect love affair. Yes, sir.
Be careful.
Oh, don't step on an ant or slug a bug or approach a roach or stick a tick in the middle of a plant or stab a crab. You know, all these hairy little insects may want to, but they can't. Not the way I do with you. Oh, not the way I do with you.
Yeah.
never swat a fly. He may have another fly. He may sit with her inside the way I do with you. Never harm a flea. He may have a favorite she that he bounces on his knee the way I do with you. Don't step on an ant in the middle of a plant. You may want to, but he can't the way I do with you.
Hey.